know why. And she held the alethiometer and closed her eyes, letting her mind fall forward, like a diver off a high cliff. Don't look for a firm place. Go into the flow. Be with it. Let it surge through me, in and out again. There's nothing firm, no perspective, she muttered to herself. Images from the dial swung at her and past her, and swung away again. Now she was upside down, now she was soaring, now plummeting into a terrible depth. Images she had known well for almost half her life lowered at her with an alien glare, or hid themselves in mist. She let herself drift, float, tumble, holding on to nothing. It was dark, and then it was dazzling. She was on an endless plain studded with fossilized emblems under a vast moon. She was in a forest, resounding with animal cries and human screams and the whisper of terrified ghosts. Ivy climbed up to envelop the sun and pull it down into a meadow where an angry black bull snorted and stamped. Through it all she drifted, intentionless, free from any human feeling. Scene after scene unfolded, banal, tender, horrible, and she watched them all, interested but detached. She wondered if she was dreaming, and whether it mattered, and how she could tell what was significant from what was trivial and accidental. I don't know, she whispered. She had begun to feel that horrible sickness which seemed to be the inevitable consequence of using the new method. She put the instrument down at once, and breathed deeply till the nausea passed. There must be a better way, she thought. Clearly something was happening, though it was hard to tell what it was. She wondered what she'd ask if she had some of the books with her, and could consult the old authorities about framing a question and interpreting the answer, and at once she knew. She'd ask about the cat in the dream. Was she Will's demon? And if so, what did that mean? She felt uncomfortable to think that, though. The universal skepticism that she'd learned from Brander and Talbot, in their different ways, made her sternly reject the world of dreams and occult significances. They were childish things, worthless rubbish. But what was the alethiometer itself, if not a way into that very world? She was horribly divided. Nevertheless, that shadow-coloured cat on the moonlit lawn. She took it up again, and turned all three hands to point to the bird, which stood for demons in general. She closed her eyes again, and cradled the instrument in her lap, holding it without any tension. She tried to summon the mood of the dream, which wasn't hard, in fact. It clung to her mind like a delicate perfume. How the demon had come towards her, confident and happy, offering her head for Lyra's knuckles to rub. How her fur had felt almost charged with adoration. How she knew the demon was Kiryava, and she was allowed to touch her because she loved Will, and how Will must be nearby. At once, the scene changed. Still entranced, she found herself in an elegant building, in a corridor, with windows opening onto a narrow courtyard below, where a large limousine gleamed in the winter sunshine. The walls of the corridor were painted or distempered a pale, chalky green in the pale sunshine of a winter afternoon. And there was the cat demon again. Or just a cat, sitting calmly this time, watching her. Not Kiryava. As Lyra, in a fire of hope and disappointment, moved towards her, the cat turned and stalked away towards an open door. Lyra followed. Through the doorway she saw a book-lined room, where a young man was holding an alethiometer. And it was Will, she said aloud. She couldn't help it. His black hair, his strong jaw, the tense way he held his shoulders. And then he looked up at her. And it wasn't Will, but someone else. About her age. Slim. Fierce. Arrogant. And he had a demon who wasn't a cat. She was a sparrowhawk, perching on the back of his chair, staring at her with yellow eyes. Where was Kiryava now? Lyra looked around. The cat had vanished, A flicker of suspicious recognition passed between Lyra and the young man, but they were recognizing different things. He knew her to be the girl his employer, Marcel Delamere, wanted so badly for some reason. The girl who had his own father's alethiometer, and she knew him to be the inventor of the new method. Before he could move, she reached in and pulled the door shut between them. Then she blinked and shook her head, and found herself in the warm bed of the trout. She was weak from wonder, and giddy with shock. He had been so like Will. That first moment, what a burst of joy in her breast! And then what a sickening disappointment, followed at once by an uneasy lurch of surprise, that she knew where that place was, and what he was doing, and who he was. And where had the cat gone? Why had she been there anyway? Was she leading Lyra to the young man? She didn't notice Pan sitting up tensely, watching her, in the chair beside the bed. She put the alethiometer on the bedside table and reached for paper and pencil. Working quickly while the vision was already fading from her mind, she wrote down everything she could. Pan watched her for a minute or two, and then quietly curled up again in the armchair. He hadn't shared her pillow for several nights. He didn't move till Lyra finished writing and turned out the light, and then he waited a little longer till her steady breathing told him she was asleep. Then he recovered a tattered little notebook from the larger book in which he'd hidden it, and held it firmly in his teeth as he jumped up to the windowsill. He had already inspected the window, which was not a sash, but a casement with a simple iron catch, so he didn't need Lyra's help to open it. A moment later, he was outside on the old stone tiles, and then a leap into an apple tree, a dart across a lawn, a scamper across the bridge, and soon he was running freely in the wide expanse of Port Meadow towards the distant campanile of St. Barnabas's oratory, pale against the night sky. He darted through a group of sleeping ponies, making them shift uneasily. Perhaps one of them was the animal whose back he'd leaped on the year before, digging his claws in till the poor creature galloped in frenzy and finally threw him off, and he'd landed on the grass, laughing with delight. That was something Lyra knew nothing about. Just as she knew nothing about the little notebook he was carrying in his teeth. It was the one from Dr. Hassel's rucksack, the one filled with names and addresses. And he'd hidden it away because he'd seen something in it that she hadn't noticed. And having hidden it, he found that the best time to tell her about it hadn't yet arrived. He ran on, light and tireless and silent, until he reached the canal that ran along the eastern edge of the meadow. Rather than swim across and risk the notebook, he slipped through the grass until he came to the little bridge across to Walton Well Road and the streets of Jericho. He'd have to be very careful from now on. It wasn't yet midnight. There were several pubs still open, and the yellow streetlights at each corner would have made it impossible to hide if he'd gone that way. Instead, he kept to the towpath, moving swiftly and stopping frequently to look and listen, until he came to an iron-barred gate on the left. He was through it in a moment, into the grounds of the Eagle Ironworks, whose great buildings loomed high above him. A narrow path led to a similar gate that opened next to the end of Juxon Street, which consisted to a terrace of small brick houses built for the workers at the ironworks or the fell press nearby. Pan stayed inside the gate, in the shadow of the buildings, because two men were talking in the street. Finally, one of them opened a door, and they said good night, and the other's footsteps moved away unsteadily towards Walton Street. Pan waited for another minute, and then slipped through the gate and over the low wall in front of the last house. He crouched beside the little window of the basement, which was dimly lit and so smoke-covered and dusty that it was impossible to see through. He was listening for the sound of a man's voice, and presently he heard it. A sentence or two in a hoarse, conversational tone, answered by a lighter and more musical one. They were there, and they were working. That was all he needed to know. He tapped on the window, and the voices stopped at once. A dark shape leaped up onto the narrow windowsill, peered out, and a moment later moved out of the way to let the man unlatch the window. Pan slipped inside, and jumped down onto the stone floor of the basement to greet the cat demon, whose black fur actually seemed to absorb light. A great furnace was blazing in the center of the room, and the heat was fierce. The place seemed like a combination of blacksmith's forge and chemical laboratory, dark with soot and thick with cobwebs.
"Pantalaimon," said the man. "Welcome. We haven't seen you for a while."
"Mr. Makepeace," said Pan, dropping the notebook in order to speak. "How are you?"
"Active, at least," said Makepeace. "You're alone."
He was aged about 70, and deeply wrinkled. His skin was mottled either by age or by the smoke that filled the air. Pan and Lyra had first encountered Sebastian Makepeace a few years before, in a strange little episode involving a witch and her demon. They had visited him a number of times since then, becoming familiar with his ironic manner, the indescribable clutter of his laboratory, his knowledge of curious things, and the kindly patience of his demon Mary. She and Makepeace knew that Lyra and Pan could separate. The witch whose deceit had brought them together had once been his lover, and he knew about the power the witches had.
"Yes," said Pan. "Lyra is... well, she's asleep. I wanted to ask you about something. I don't want to interrupt you."
Makepeace put on a battered gauntlet and adjusted the position of an iron vessel at the edge of the furnace.
"That can go on heating for a while," he said. "Sit down, my boy. I'll smoke while we talk."
He took a small cheroot from a drawer and lit it. Pan liked the scent of smoke leaf, but wondered if he'd smell it at all in this atmosphere. The alchemist sat on a stool and looked at him directly.
"Very well. What's in that notebook?"
Pan picked it up and held it for him to take, and then told him about the murder and the events that had followed. Makepeace listened closely, and Mary sat at his feet, eyes on Pan as he spoke.
"And the reason I hid it," Pan finished, "and the reason I brought it here, is that your name's in it. It's a sort of address book. Lyra didn't notice that, but I did."
"Let me have a look," said Makepeace.
He put on his spectacles. His demon sprang up to his lap, and they both looked closely at the list of names of people and their demons and their addresses in the little book. Each name and address was written in a different hand. They weren't in alphabetical order. In fact, they seemed to Pan to be ordered geographically, east to west, starting from somewhere called Quaresma and ending in Edinburgh, taking in cities and towns in most European countries. Pan had studied it secretly 3 or 4 times and could find nothing to hint at the connection between them. The alchemist seemed to be searching for some names in particular.
"Your name's the only one in Oxford," Pan said. "I just wondered if you knew about this list, and why he might have been carrying it."
"You said he could separate from his demon."
"Just before he died, yes. She flew up to the tree and asked me to help."
"Why haven't you told Lyra about this?"
It just never seemed to be the right time."
"That's unfortunate," said Makepeace. "Well, you should give it to her. It's very valuable. There's a name for this kind of list. It's known as a clavicular adjumenti."
He pointed to a small pair of embossed letters inside the back cover, at the foot next to the spine. C.A. The little book was so rubbed and battered that they were hardly visible. Then he flicked through the pages to about halfway through, took a short pencil out of his waistcoat pocket, and turned the notebook sideways before writing something in it.
"What does that mean?" said Pan. "Clavicular... and who are these people? Do you know them all? I couldn't see any connection between the names."
"No, you wouldn't."
"What did you write?"
"A name that was missing."
"Why did you turn it sideways?"
"To fit it on the page, of course. I say this again. Give it to Lyra, and come back here with her. Then I'll tell you what it means. Not until you're both here together."
"That won't be easy," said Pan. "We hardly talk nowadays. We keep quarrelling. It's horrible, and we just can't stop it."
"What do you quarrel about?"
"Last time, earlier this evening, it was imagination. I said she had no imagination, and she was upset."
Are you surprised?
No, I suppose not.
Why were you arguing about imagination?
I don't even know anymore. We probably didn't mean the same thing by it.
You won't understand anything about the imagination until you realize that it's not about making things up. It's about perception. What else have you been quarreling about?
Oh, all kinds of things. She's changed. She's been reading books that... Have you heard of Gottfried Brander?
No, but don't tell me what you think about him. Tell me what Lyra would say.
All right, I'll try. Brander is a philosopher. They call him the Sage of Wittenberg, or some people do. He wrote an enormous novel called The Hypocharasmians. I don't even know what that means. He doesn't refer to it in the text.
I would mean those who live beyond Charasmia, which is to say the region to the east of the Caspian Sea. It's now known as Quaresma, and...
What? I think that name's on the list.
Makepeace opened the notebook again and nodded.
Yes, here it is. And what does Lyra think of this novel?
She's been sort of hypnotized by it. Ever since she...
You're telling me what you think. Tell me what she would say if I asked her about it.
Well, she'd say it was a work of enormous, scope and power. A completely convincing world, unlike anything else she'd ever read. A new view of human nature that shattered all her previous convictions and showed her life in a completely new perspective. Something like that, probably.
You're being satirical.
I can't help it. I hate it. Characters are monstrously selfish and blind to every human feeling. They're either arrogant and dominating or cringing and deceitful or else foppish and artistic and useless. There's only one value in his world, which is reason. God, the author's so rational, he's insane. Nothing else has any importance at all. To him, the imagination is just meaningless and contemptible. The whole universe he describes is just arid.
Well, if he's a philosopher, why did he write a novel? Does he think the novel is a good form for philosophy?
He's written various other books, but this is the only one he's famous for. We haven't... Lyra hasn't read any of the others.
The alchemist flicked the ash from his cheroot into the furnace and gazed at the fire. His demon Mary sat beside his feet, eyes half closed, purring steadily.
"Have you ever known anyone and their demon who hated each other?"
Pan said after a minute had gone by.
"Well, it's more common than you might think."
"Even among people who can't separate?"
"It might be worse for them."
Pan thought.
"Yes, it would be."
Steam was rising from the iron vessel on the fire.
"Mr. Makepeace," he said, "what are you working at now?"
"I'm making some soup," said the alchemist.
"Oh," said Pan, and then realized the old man was joking. "No, what really?"
"You know what I mean by a field?"
"Like a magnetic field?"
"Yes, but this one is very hard to detect."
"What does it do?"
"I'm trying to imagine."
"But if you..." "Oh, I see. You mean you're trying to perceive it?"
"That's right."
"Do you need special equipment?"
"You could probably do it with immensely expensive instruments that used colossal amounts of power and took up acres of space. I'm limited to what's here in my laboratory. Some gold leaf, several mirrors, a bright light, various bits and pieces I've had to invent."
"Does it work?"
"Of course it works."
"I remember the first time we met you. You told Lyra that if people think you're trying to make gold out of lead, they think you're wasting time and they don't bother to find out what you're really doing."
"Yes, I did."
"Were you trying to find this field then?"
"Yes. Now I've found it, I'm trying to discover whether it's the same everywhere, or whether it varies."
"Do you use all the things you've got down here?"
"They all have a use."
And what are you making in the iron pot?
Soup, as I told you.
He got up to stir it. Pan suddenly felt tired. He'd learned some things, but they weren't necessarily helpful. And now he had to go all the way back across Port Meadow and hide the notebook again, and, sometime, tell Lyra about it.
Clavicular, he said, trying to remember, and Makepeace added, adjumenti.
Adjumenti. I'm going to go now. Thank you for explaining this. Enjoy your soup.
Tell Lyra, and tell her soon, and come here with her.
The black cat demon stood to touch noses with him, and Pan left. Chapter 10 The Linnaeus Room. Next morning, a letter arrived by hand at Durham College for Malcolm. He opened it in the porter's lodge and saw that the paper was headed Director's Office, Botanic Garden, Oxford, and read, Dear Dr. Pulstead, I feel I should have been more frank with you yesterday about Dr. Hassel and his research. The fact is that circumstances are changing rapidly, and the matter is more urgent than it might seem. We have been organizing a small meeting between various parties who have an interest in the case, and I wondered if you could possibly attend. Your knowledge of the area and of the items you found means that you might be able to contribute to our discussion. I wouldn't ask, but it's both serious and urgent. We are meeting this evening at 6 here at the garden. If you can come, and I very much hope you will, please ask at the gate for the Linnaeus Room. Yours sincerely, Lucy Arnold. He looked at the date on the letter. It had been written that same morning. Asta, on reading it with him from the counter of the porter's window, said, We should tell Hannah. Is there time? He had a college meeting at mid-morning. He peered into the lodge and read the time from the porter's clock. 9:05. Yes, we can do it, he said. I meant for her, Asta said. She's going to London this morning. So she is. Better hurry then, Malcolm said, and Asta leaped down and padded after him. 10 minutes later, he was ringing Hannah Ralph's doorbell, and 30 seconds after that she was letting him in and saying, So you've seen the Oxford Times? No, what's that about? She held out the newspaper. It was the evening edition from the day before, and she turned it back to page 5, where a headline read, Body found at Iffley Lock. Not drowned, say police. He scanned the story quickly. Iffley Lock was about 1 mile down the river from where Pan had seen the attack, and the lockkeeper had found the body of a man of about 40 who had been brutally beaten, and who appeared to have died before his body entered the water. The police had opened a murder inquiry.
Must be him, said Malcolm. Poor man.
Well, Lucy Arnold will know by now. Perhaps that's what she's referring to.
What are you talking about?
I came to show you this, he said, and handed her the letter.
Circumstances are changing rapidly, Hannah read.
Yes, could well be. She's very cautious. Doesn't mention the police. If there was nothing on the body to identify him, they wouldn't know who he was, and she still might not know about it. Do you know anything about her? Ever met her?
I know her slightly. Intense, passionate woman. Almost tragic, I've sometimes thought. Or felt, rather. I've got no reason for thinking it.
Well, that doesn't matter. It's part of the picture. Anyway, I'm going to go to this meeting of hers. Will you see Glenys in London, do you think?
Yes, she'll certainly be there. I'll make sure she knows.
She took her overcoat from the hat stand.
How's Lyra getting on? She said,
as he held the coat for her. Subdued. Not surprising, really.
Well, tell her to come and see me when she has an hour or so. Oh, Malcolm, Dr. Strauss's journey through the desert and the Red Building.
What about it?
That word, actorike. Any idea what it could mean?
None, I'm afraid. It's not a Tajik word, as far as I can tell.
Oh, well, I wonder if the alethiometer could clarify it. See you later.
Give my regards to Glenys.
Glenys Godwin was the current director of Oakley Street. Thomas Nugent, who had been director when Hannah joined the organization, had died earlier in the year, and Hannah was going to his memorial service. Mrs. Godwin had had to retire as a field officer some years before when she contracted a tropical fever, which had had the effect of paralyzing her demon. But her judgment was both sound and daring, and her demon's memory was fine-grained and extensive. Malcolm admired her greatly. She was a widow, whose only child had died of the same fever that had infected her, and she was the first woman to head Oakley Street. Her political enemies had been waiting in vain for her to make a mistake. After the memorial service, Hannah managed to speak to her for 10 minutes. They were sitting in a quiet corner of the hotel lounge where several other Oakley Street people were having drinks. She briskly summarized everything she knew about the murder, the rucksack, Strauss's journal, and Malcolm's invitation to this hastily summoned meeting. Glenys Godwin was in her 50s, small and stocky, her dark grey hair neatly and plainly styled. Her face was quick with feeling and movement. Too expressive, Hannah had often thought, to be helpful to someone in her position, where a steely inscrutability might have been preferable. Her left hand moved gently over her demon, a small civet cat who lay on her lap listening closely. When Hannah had finished, she said, "The young woman, Lyra Silvertongue, was it? Unusual name. Where is she now?" "Staying with Malcolm's parents. They have a pub on the river." "Does she need protection?" "Yes, I think she does. She's... do you know about her background?" "No. Tell me sometime, but not now. Clearly Malcolm must go to this meeting. It's very much Oakley Street business. There's an experimental theology connection, we know that much. A man called..."
"Brewster Napier,"
said the ghost-like voice of her demon. "That's the one. He published a paper a couple of years ago, which first drew our attention to it. What was it called?"
"Some effects of rose oil in polarized light microscopy,"
said Godwin's demon.
"In proceedings of the Microscopical Institute of Leiden, Napier and Stevenson, 2 years ago."
His words were quiet and strained, but perfectly clear. Not for the first time, Hannah marveled at his memory. "Have you been in contact with this Napier?" Hannah asked. "Not directly. We checked his background very carefully and quietly, and he's perfectly sound. As far as we know, the implications of his paper haven't been noticed by the Magisterium, and we don't want to prompt them by taking an overt interest ourselves. This business that Malcolm's come across is just another indication that something's stirring. I'm glad you told me about it. You say he's copied all the papers from the rucksack?" "Everything. I imagine he'll get them to you by Monday. I look forward to it." At about the same time, Lyra was talking to the kitchen helper at the Trout. Pauline was 17 years old, pretty and shy, inclined to blush easily. While Pan was talking under the kitchen table with her mouse demon, Pauline chopped up some onions and Lyra peeled potatoes. "Well, he used to teach me a bit," Lyra said, in answer to a question about how she knew Malcolm. "But I was being horrible to everyone in those days. I never thought of him having a life at all apart from college. I used to think they put him away in a cupboard at night." "How long have you been working here?"
"I started last year, just part-time like. Then Brenda asked me to do a few more hours, and I work at Boswell's too, Mondays and Thursdays."
"Do you? Oh, I worked at Boswell's for a bit. Kitchenware. Ooh, it was hard work."
"I'm in haberdashery."
She finished the onions and put them in a large casserole on the range.
"What are you making?" said Lyra. "Just starting a venison casserole. Brenda will do most of it. She's got some special spices she puts in. I don't know what they are. I'm just learning, really."
"Does she cook one big dish every day?"
"She used to. Mainly roasts and that, joints on the spit. Then Malcolm suggested varying it a bit. He had some really good ideas."
She was blushing again. She turned away to stir the onions, which were spitting in the fat. "Have you known Malcolm for a long time?" Lyra said.
"Yeah, I suppose. When I was little, I thought he was... I don't know, really. He was always nice to me. I used to think he'd take over the pub when Reg retired. But somehow I can't see that anymore, really. He's more of a professor now. I don't see him so much."
"Would you like to run a pub?"
Oh, I couldn't."
"It'd be fun, though." Pauline's demon scampered up to her shoulder and whispered in her ear, and the girl bowed her head and shook it slightly to let her dark curls swing down and hide her flaming cheeks. She gave the onions a final stir and put the lid on the casserole before moving it a little away from the heat. Lyra watched without seeming to. She found herself fascinated by the girl's embarrassment, and was sorry to have caused it, without knowing why. A little later, when they were sitting on the terrace watching the river flow past, Pan told her, "She's in love with him," he said.
"What? With Malcolm?"
Lyra was incredulous. "And if you hadn't been so wrapped up in yourself, you'd have seen that straight away."
"I'm not,"
she said, but she sounded unconvinced even to herself.
"But surely he's too old."
"She doesn't think so, obviously. Anyway, I don't suppose he's in love with her."
"Did her demon tell you that?"
"He didn't have to." Lyra was shocked, and she had no idea why. It wasn't shocking, it was just, well, it was Dr. Polstead. But then, he was different now. He was even dressing differently. At home in the Trout, Malcolm wore a checked shirt with the sleeves rolled up, showing the golden hair on his forearms, a moleskin waistcoat, and corduroy trousers. He looked like a farmer, she thought, and very little like a scholar. He appeared to be perfectly at home in this world of watermen and farm labourers, of poachers and travelling salesmen. Calm and burly and good-natured, he seemed to have been part of this place all his life. Which, of course, he had. It was no wonder that he served drinks so expertly, talked so easily with strangers as well as regulars, dealt with problems so efficiently. The evening before, two customers had nearly come to blows over a game of cards, and Malcolm had them outside almost before Lyra had noticed. She wasn't sure that she felt at ease with this new Malcolm any more than the old Dr. Polstead, but she could see that he was someone to be respected. To fall in love with, though. She resolved to avoid talking about him again. She liked Pauline, and didn't want to think she'd embarrassed her. When Malcolm arrived at the Botanic Garden just before 6, he saw a light in one window of the administrative building. Apart from that, the place was dark. The porter's shutter was closed, and he tapped on it gently. He heard a movement inside, and saw a glow forming at the edge of the shutter, as if someone had arrived with a lamp.
"Garden's closed," said a voice from inside.
"Yes, but I've come for a meeting with Professor Arnold. She told me to ask for the Linnaeus room."
"Name, sir?"
"Polstead. Malcolm Polstead."
"Right, got it. Main door's open, and the Linnaeus room is one floor up, second on the right."
The main door of the administrative building faced into the garden. It was faintly lit by a light at the top of the stairs, and Malcolm found the Linnaeus room just along the corridor from the director's office, where he'd seen Professor Arnold the day before. He knocked on the door, and heard a murmur of conversation come to a stop. The door opened, and Lucy Arnold stood there. Malcolm remembered Hannah's word, tragic. That was her expression, and he knew at once that she'd heard of the discovery of Hassel's body. "I hope I'm not late," he said.
"No, please do come in. We haven't started yet, but there's no one else to come."
Apart from her, there were 5 people sitting at the conference table in the light of 2 low-hanging ambaric lamps that left the corners of the room in semi-darkness. He knew 2 of them slightly. One was an expert on Asian politics from St. Edmund Hall, and the other was a clergyman called Charles Capes. Malcolm knew him to be a theologian, but Hannah had told him that Capes was in fact a secret friend of Oakley Street. Malcolm took his place at the table as Lucy Arnold sat down.
"We're all here," she said. "Let's begin. For those who haven't already heard, the police found a body in the river yesterday, and it's been identified as that of Roderick Hassel."
She was speaking with a stern self-control, but Malcolm thought he could hear a tremor in her voice. One or 2 of the others around the table uttered a murmur of shock or of sympathy. She went on.
"I've asked you all here because I think we need to share our knowledge about this matter and decide what to do next. I don't think you all know one another, so I'll ask you to introduce yourselves briefly. Charles, could you start?"
Charles Capes was a small, tidy man of 60 or so, who wore a clerical collar. His demon was a lemur.
"Charles Capes, Thackeray Professor of Divinity," he said. "But I'm here because I knew Roderick Hassel, and I've spent some time in the region where he was working."
The woman next to him, about Malcolm's age and very pale and anxious-looking, said,
"Annabel Milner, Plant Sciences. I'd been working with Dr. Hassel on the Rose question before he went to Lucknow.
Malcolm was next. Malcolm Polstead, historian. I found some papers in a bag at a bus stop. Dr. Hassel's name and university card happened to be among them, so I brought them here. Like Professor Capes, I've worked in the same part of the world, so I was curious. The person sitting next to him was a slim, dark-featured man in his 50s, whose demon was a hawk. He nodded to Malcolm and said,
Timur Kazarian, my area of interest is the history and politics of Central Asia. I had several conversations with Dr. Hassel about the region before he went there.
The next to speak was a sandy-haired man with a Scottish accent. My name is Brewster Napier. Together with my colleague, Marjorie Stevenson, I wrote the first paper about the rose oil effect in microscopy. In view of what's happened since, I was alarmed and profoundly interested to hear from Lucy this morning. Like Professor Kazarian, I spoke with Dr. Hassel last time he was in Oxford. I'm shocked to hear about his death. The final person was a man a little older than Malcolm, with thin, fair hair and a long jaw. His expression was somber.
Lars Johnson, he said. I was the director of the research station at Pashpulak before Ted Cartwright took over, the place where Roderick had been working.
Lucy Arnold said, Thank you. I'll start. The police came to me this morning to ask if I could identify the body that had been found in the river. There was a name tag inside the dead man's shirt, and they connected his name with the garden. Staff lists are easy enough to come by. I went with them, and yes, it was him. It was Roderick. I never want to have to do that again. He'd clearly been murdered. The strange thing is that the motive doesn't seem to have been robbery. Yesterday morning, Dr. Polstead, she looked at him, found a shopping bag in the Abingdon Road, which contained Roderick's wallet and a number of other things, and he brought it to me. Frankly, the police didn't seem very interested in that. I gather they think it was just a meaningless attack. But I've asked you all here because you each have a part of the knowledge we'll need in order to move forward with understanding what's happened and what's continuing to happen. This is... The thing is, I think we're treading on dangerous ground. I'll ask you each to speak in turn, and then we'll open it up to a more general... Brewster, could you tell us how it began for you?
Oh, by all means, he said. A couple of years ago, a technician in my laboratory noticed that she was having trouble with a particular microscope and asked me to look at it. There was one lens which was misbehaving in an unusual way. You know when you have a smear of dirt or oil on your spectacles, one part of the visual field is blurred. But this wasn't like that. Instead, there was a coloured fringe around the specimen she was looking at. Quite definite in character. No blurring, no lack of clarity. Everything we could see was unusually well-defined. And in addition, there was that coloured fringe, which, well, it moved and sparkled. We investigated and discovered that the previous user of the microscope had been examining a specimen of a particular kind of rose from a region of Central Asia and had accidentally touched the lens, transferring a very small quantity of oil from the specimen to the glass. Not very good microscopy, to be honest, but it was interesting that it had that effect. I took the lens and put it aside because I wanted to see exactly what was happening. On a hunch, I asked my friend Marjorie Stevenson to have a look at it. Marjorie's a particle physicist, and something she told me a month or two before made me think she'd be interested in this. She was investigating the Rosakoff field. Malcolm sensed a slight shiver of tension around the table, perhaps because he felt it himself. Nobody spoke or moved. Napier continued, For those who haven't come across it before, the Rosakoff field and the particles associated with it are aspects of the phenomenon known as dust, which of course is not to be spoken about without the specific authority of the Magisterium. I'm assured by Lucy that you're all aware of the constraints this places on our activities and our conversations. He looked directly at Malcolm as he said this. Malcolm nodded blandly, and Napier went on. Briefly, Marjorie Stevenson and I discovered that the oil on the lens made it possible to see various effects of the Rosakoff field, which had previously only been described theoretically. There have been rumours for a decade or so that something like it had been seen before, but any records have been systematically destroyed by... Well, we know who. The question now was whether to keep this discovery secret or make it public. It was too important to say nothing about, but perhaps too dangerous to make much of a noise. Where should we place it? The Microscopical Society of Leiden is not, frankly, a very influential body, and its proceedings are seldom noticed. So, we sent a paper there, and it was published a couple of years ago. At first, we heard nothing in response, but more recently, both my laboratory and Marjorie's have been broken into, very skillfully, and we've both been questioned by people we assumed had some connection with security or intelligence or something. They were discreet, but quite probing, very persistent, rather alarming, in fact. We told them nothing but the truth in return. Well, that's all I need say for the moment, I think, except to add that Marjorie now works in Cambridge, and that I haven't heard from her for the past fortnight. Her colleagues can't tell me where she is, and neither can her husband. I'm extremely anxious about her. Thank you, Brewster, said Lucy Arnold. That's very helpful. Clear and alarming. Dr. Polstead, could you tell us what you know? She looked somberly at Malcolm. He nodded. As Professor Arnold has told you, he began. But then there came a soft, hurried knock on the door. Everyone looked around. Lucy Arnold stood up instinctively. Her face was pale. Yes, she said. The door opened. The porter came in quickly and said,
Professor, there's some men wanting to see you. I think maybe CCD. I told them you was having a meeting in the Humboldt room, but they'll be up here soon enough. They ain't got a warrant. Said they didn't need one.
Malcolm said at once, Where's the Humboldt room?
In the other wing, said Lucy Arnold, almost too quietly to be heard. She was trembling. No one else had moved.
Malcolm said to the porter, Well done. Now, I'd like you to guide everyone here except me, Charles, and the director out into the garden and away through the side gate before these men realize what's happened. Can you do that?
Yes, sir.
Then everyone else please follow. Make as little noise as you can, but go quickly. Charles Capes was watching Malcolm. The other four got up and left with the porter. Lucy Arnold, gripping the doorframe, watched as they hurried away down the corridor.
Better come back and sit down, said Malcolm, who was replacing the chairs to look as if they hadn't been moved out from the table.
Nicely done, said Capes. Now, what shall we be talking about when they arrive?
But who are they? Said the director, sounding distressed. Are they from the Consistorial Court of Discipline, do you think? What can they want?
Malcolm said, Stay calm. Nothing you've done or we're doing is wrong or illegal or in any way the business of the CCD. We'll say that I'm here because, having brought the bag to you, I wondered if you'd had any news of Hassel. I didn't connect him with the body in the river till you told me about it, as you just have done. Charles is here because I'd been going to see him anyway about the Lop Nor region, and I told him about Hassel's bag, and he mentioned that he knew him, so we decided to come here together.
What did you ask me about Lop Nor? Said Capes. He was perfectly calm and composed.
Oddly enough, I asked about the sort of thing you would have told this meeting if we hadn't been interrupted. What were you going to say?
It was local folklore, really. The shamans know about those roses.
Do they?
What do they know? Well, they come from the roses, I mean, from the heart of the desert of Karamakan, so the story goes. They won't grow anywhere else. If you put a drop of the oil in your eye, you'll see visions. But you have to be determined, because it stings like hell. So I'm told.
You haven't tried it yourself?
Certainly not. The thing about that desert is that you can't enter it without separating from your demon. It's one of those odd places. There's another in Siberia, I believe, and I think in the Atlas Mountains as well, where demons find it too uncomfortable or too painful to go. So the roses come at a considerable cost, you see. A personal cost, as well as a financial one.
I thought people died if they did that, said Lucy Arnold.
Not always, apparently, but it's horribly painful.
Was that what Hassel had been going to investigate? Said Malcolm, who knew full well what the answer would be, but who was interested to see whether she did, or whether she'd admit it.
But before she could answer, there was a knock on the door. It was much louder than the porter's, and the door opened before anyone could respond.
Professor Arnold.
The speaker was a man in a dark overcoat and a trilby hat. Two other men stood behind him, similarly dressed.
Yes, she said. Who are you, and what do you want?
Her voice was perfectly steady.
I was told you were in the Humboldt room.
Well, we came here instead. What do you want?
We want to ask you a few questions, he said, stepping further into the room. The other two men followed him.
Wait a minute, said Malcolm. You haven't answered Professor Arnold's question. Who are you?
The man took out a wallet and flipped it open to show a card. It bore the letters CCD in bold uppercase, navy blue on ochre. My name's Hartland, he said. Captain Hartland.
Well, how can I help you? Said Lucy Arnold.
What are you discussing in here?
Folklore, said Charles Capes.
Who asked you? Said Hartland.
Oh, I thought you did.
I'm asking her.
We were discussing folklore, she said flatly.
Why?
Because we're scholars. I'm interested in the folklore of plants and flowers. Professor Capes is an expert on folklore, among other things, and Dr. Polstead is a historian with an interest in the same field.
What do you know about a man called Roderick Hassel?
She closed her eyes for a moment, then said, He was a colleague of mine, and a friend. I had to identify his body this morning.
Did you know him? Hartland asked Capes.
Yes, I did.
You? To Malcolm.
No.
Why'd you bring his stuff here, then, yesterday?
Because I could see that he worked here.
Well, why not to the police?
Because I didn't know he was dead. How could I? I thought he'd left it there by mistake, and the simplest thing would be to bring it straight to his place of work.
Where are those things now?
In London, Malcolm said. Lucy Arnold blinked. Keep still, Malcolm thought. He saw one of the other two men leaning forward at the far end of the table, his hands on the edge.
Where in London? Who's got them?
Hartland said.
After Professor Arnold had looked at them with me, and I'd heard for the first time that he was missing, we decided that it would be a good idea to ask an expert at the Royal Institute of Ethnology about them. There was a lot of material that had a bearing on folklore, which I knew very little about, so I gave it to a friend to take it there yesterday.
What's your friend's name? Could he confirm this?
He could if he was here, but he's going on to Paris.
And this expert at the, what was it?
Royal Institute of Ethnology.
What's his name?
Richardson? Something like that. I don't know him personally.
You're being a bit bloody careless with this stuff, aren't you? Considering there's a murder involved?
Well, as I've just pointed out, we didn't know there was at that stage. Naturally, we'd have taken it straight to the police if we had known. But as Professor Arnold said, the police weren't interested when she mentioned it to them.
Why are you interested? Asked Charles Capes. It's my job to be interested in all sorts of things, said Hartland. What was Hassel doing in Central Asia?
Botanical research, said Lucy Arnold. There was a hesitant knock at the door, and the porter looked in.
Sorry, Professor, he said. I thought you was in the Humboldt room. I've been looking all over. Oh, these gentlemen found you, then?
Yes, thank you, John, she said. They've just finished. Could you show them out?
With a speculative look at Malcolm, Hartland nodded slowly and turned to go. The other two followed him out, leaving the door open. Malcolm put his finger to his lips. Hush! Then he waited for a count of 10, closed the door, and moved silently to the end of the table where the man had been leaning. He beckoned the other two to come and look. Crouching down, he looked under the edge and pointed to a dull black object about the size of the top joint of his thumb, which seemed to be stuck to the underside. Lucy Arnold caught her breath, and again Malcolm put his finger to his lips. He touched the black thing with the point of a pencil, and it scuttled away to the corner by the leg of the table. Malcolm shook his handkerchief open and held it underneath before flicking the creature off with the pencil. He caught it and wrapped up the handkerchief tightly, with the thing buzzing inside it. "What's that?" whispered Lucy. Malcolm held it on the table, eased off his shoe, and hit the creature hard with the heel. "It's a spy fly," he said quietly. "They've bred them smaller and smaller, with better memories. It would have listened to what we said next, and flown back to them and repeated it exactly." "Smallest I've seen," said Charles Capes. Malcolm checked that it was dead, and dropped it out of the window.
"I thought it might be an idea to leave it and let them waste time listening to it," he said. "But then you'd always have to be careful what people said in here, and that would be a nuisance. Besides, it can move about, so you'd never be sure where it was. Better to let them think it just failed."
"It's the first I've heard of a Royal Institute of Ethnology," said Capes.
What about those papers?
Where are they really?
In my office, Lucy Arnold said. There are some samples, too, seeds, that sort of thing.
Well, we can't stay there, said Malcolm. When those men come back, they'll have a search warrant. Shall I take the papers away?
Why not let me? Said Capes. I'm curious to read them apart from anything else, and there are plenty of places to hide things in our cellars at Wickham.
All right, she said. Yes, thank you. I don't know what to do.
If you don't mind, said Malcolm, I'd like to take the book of Tajik poetry. There's something I want to check. You know Jahan and Roxana, he added to Capes.
He was carrying a copy of that, was he? How odd.
Yes, and I want to find out why. As for the CCD, when they discover there's no Ethnology Institute, they'll come straight back to me, said Malcolm. But I'll have thought of something else by then. Let's go and get those things right now.
Lyra walked along the river during the afternoon, with Pan in sullen attendance. From time to time, he seemed to want to say something, but she was deep in a mood of wintry isolation, so in the end he slouched as far behind her as he could get without arousing suspicion, and said nothing. As the late afternoon light thickened into gloom under the trees, and a mist that was almost a drizzle began to fill the air, she found herself hoping that Malcolm would be there when she got back to the trout. She wanted to ask him about... Oh, she couldn't remember. It would come to her. And she wanted to watch Pauline with him, to see whether Pan's crazy idea could be true. But Malcolm didn't come, and she didn't want to ask where he was in case she didn't know what. So it was in a state of frustrated melancholy that she went to bed, and there wasn't even anything she wanted to read. She took up the Hypercharasmians and opened it at random, but the heroic intensity that had once intoxicated her now seemed out of reach. And Pan wouldn't settle. He prowled about the little room, leaping up to the windowsill, listening at the door, exploring the wardrobe, until finally she said, "Oh, for God's sake, just go to bloody sleep." "Not sleepy," he said. "Neither are you." "Well, can't you stop fidgeting?"
"Lyra, why are you so difficult to talk to?"
"Me?"
"I need to tell you something, but you make it difficult."
"I'm listening."
"No, you're not. Not properly."
"I don't know what I've got to do to listen properly. Am I supposed to use the imagination that I haven't got?"
"I didn't mean that.
Anyway, of course you meant it. You said it clearly enough."
"Well, I've thought more since then. When I went out last night..."
"I don't want to hear about it. I knew you were out, and I know you were talking to someone, and I'm just not interested."
"Lyra, it's important. Please listen."
He sprang onto the bedside table. She said nothing, but subsided onto the pillow and looked up at the ceiling. Finally, she said,
"Well, I can't talk to you if you're in this mood." "Oh, this is impossible. I'm trying to work out the best way to..."
"Just say it!" Silence. He sighed, and then he said,
"You know, in the rucksack, all those things we found in there? Well, one of them was a notebook with names and addresses in it. What about it?" "You didn't see the name I saw in it."
"Whose name?"
"Sebastian Makepeace."
She sat up.
"Where was it?" "In the notebook, like I said. The only name and address in Oxford." "When did you see that?" "When you were flicking through it." "Well, why didn't you tell me? I thought you were bound to see it yourself. Anyway, you're not easy to tell anything these days." "Oh, don't be so stupid. You could have told me that. Where is it now? Has Malcolm got it?"
"No, I hid it."
"Why?
Where is it now?"
"Because I wanted to find out why he was in it, Mr. Makepeace. And last night I went out and took it to him."
Lyra almost choked with rage. For a moment she couldn't breathe. She found her entire body trembling. Pan saw it clearly, and leaped off the bedside table and onto the armchair.
"Lyra, if you don't listen, I can't tell you what he said."
"You filthy little rat," she said. She was almost sobbing, and she couldn't recognize her own voice or stop herself saying detestable things, or even know why she was saying them. "You cheat! You thief! You let me down the other night when you let her... his demon, the cat! You let her see you with a wallet! And now you do this! You go behind my back! Because you wouldn't listen. You're not listening now." "No, because I can't trust you anymore.
You're a fucking stranger to me, Pan. I can't tell you how much I detest it when you do this sort of thing. If I hadn't asked him, I'd never... And I used to... Oh, how much I used to trust you. You were everything. You were like a rock. I could have... Betraying me like that. Betray? Listen to yourself. You think I'll ever forget you betraying me in the world of the dead?
Lyra felt as if someone had kicked her in the heart. She fell back on the bed.
Don't,
she whispered.
It was the worst thing you ever did.
She knew exactly what he meant, and her mind had flown back at once to the bank of the river in the world of the dead, and that terrible moment when she left him behind in order to go and find the ghost of her friend Roger. I know, she said. She could hardly hear her own voice through the hammering of her heart. I know it was. And you know why I did it.
You knew you were going to do it, and you didn't tell me. I didn't know. How could I have known? We only heard you couldn't come with us at the last minute. We were together. We'd always be together. That's what I thought, what I wanted. Always together, forever. But then the old man told us that you couldn't go any further. And Will didn't even know he had a demon. He had to do the same thing, leave part of himself behind. Oh, Pan, you can't think I planned it like that. You can't think I'm that cruel. Then why haven't you ever asked me about it? About what it felt like for me? But we have talked about it. Only because I brought it up. You never wanted to know. Pan, that isn't fair. You just didn't want to face it. I was ashamed. I had to do it. And I was bitterly ashamed to do it. And I'd have been ashamed not to do it. And I felt guilty ever since. And if you haven't been aware of that...
When the old man rolled you out into the dark, I felt torn open, he said. His voice was shaking.
It nearly killed me. But the worst thing, worse than the pain, was the abandonment. That you should just leave me there alone. Do you realize how I gazed and stared and called out to you and tried so hard to keep you in sight as you moved off into the dark? The last thing I could see was your hair. The very last thing I could see till the dark swallowed it up. I'd have been willing just to have that, just a little gleam of your hair, just the faintest patch of light that was you, as long as it stayed there so I could see it. I'd have been waiting there still, just to know you were there, and I could see you. I'd never have moved away, as long as I could see that.
He stopped. She was sobbing.
You think I...
She tried to say, but her voice wouldn't let her.
Roger,
she managed, but that was all. The sobbing overtook her completely. Pan sat on the table and watched her for a few moments, and then, with a convulsive movement, he twisted away, as if he were weeping too. But neither of them said a word, or made any attempt to reach for the other. She lay curled in a ball, her head in her arms, weeping till the passion subsided. When she could sit up, she wiped the tears from her cheeks, and saw him lying tense and trembling with his back to her.
Pan,
she said, her voice thick with weeping.
Pan, I do realize, and I hated myself then. And I'll always hate myself for as long as I live. I hate every part of me that isn't you. And I'll have to live with that. Sometimes I think, if I could kill myself... Without killing you. I might do it. I'm so unhappy. I don't deserve to be happy, I know that. I know the world of the dead. I know what I did was horrible. And to leave Roger there would have been wrong too. And it was the worst thing ever. You're completely right. And I'm sorry. I really am. With all my heart.
He didn't move. In the silence of the night, she could hear him weeping too. Then he said,
"It's not just what you did then. It's what you're doing now. I told you this the other day, you're killing yourself and me with the way you're thinking. You're in a world full of colour, and you want to see it in black and white. As if Gottfried Brander was some kind of enchanter who made you forget everything you used to love. Everything mysterious. All the places where the shadows are. Can't you see the emptiness of the worlds they describe, him and Talbot? You don't really think the universe is as arid as that. You can't. You're under a spell. You must be.
Pan, there aren't any spells, she said, but so quietly that she hoped he wouldn't hear it.
And the world of the dead, I suppose, he said.
It was all just a childish dream. The other worlds, the subtle knife, the witches. Well, there's no room for them in the universe you want to believe in.
How do you think the alethiometer works? I suppose the symbols have got so many meanings you can read anything you want into them, so they don't mean anything at all, really. As for me, oh, I'm just a trick of the mind. The wind whistling through an empty skull. Lyra, I really think I've had enough. What do you mean? And stop breathing on me. You stink of garlic.
She turned away in humiliation and misery. Each of them lay weeping in the darkness. When she woke up in the morning, he wasn't there. Chapter 11. The Knot. Fog and cobwebs. Her mind was full of them, and so was the room, so was the dream she'd woken from.
Pan, she said, and hardly recognized her own voice. Pan!
No reply. No scuttle of claws on the floorboards. No feather-like leap onto the bed.
Pan! What are you doing? Where are you?
She ran to the window, flung back the curtain, saw the ruins of the priory and the pearly glimmer of dawn. The wide world was out there still. No fog, no cobwebs, and no Pan. In here? Was he under the bed, in a cupboard, on top of the wardrobe? Of course not. This wasn't a game. Then she saw her rucksack on the floor beside the bed. She hadn't left it there. And on top of it there was the little black notebook of Hassel's that Pan had spoken about. She picked it up. It was worn and stained, and many of the pages had corners that had been folded back. She flicked through it, seeing now, as he had, how the addresses seemed to trace the course of a journey, from a mysterious Quaresm to a house in the Lawn Market, Edinburgh. And there was Sebastian Makepeace, in Juxon Street, Oxford, just as he'd said. Why hadn't the name caught her eye? Why hadn't she noticed what Pan was doing when he hid it? How many thousands of other things had she failed to see? And then a note fell out. She snatched up the scrap of paper with shaking hands. Pan's claws weren't formed to hold a pencil, but he could write in a fashion by holding one in his mouth. It said, "Gone to look for your imagination." That was all. She sat down, feeling weightless, transparent, disembodied.
"How could you be so?"
she whispered, not knowing how to finish the question.
"How can I live like—"
Her alarm clock showed the time to be 6:30. The pub was quiet. Mr. and Mrs. Polstead would be getting up soon to make breakfast, to light fires, to do whatever else had to be done every morning. How could she tell them this? And Malcolm wasn't there. She could have told him. When would he come? Surely he'd come soon. There was work to be done. He must come. But then she thought, how can I tell them? How can I show myself to them like this? It would be shameful. It would be worse than mortifying. These people whom she hardly knew, who'd taken her in, whom she was growing to like so much. How could she inflict a monstrosity like herself now, a half-person, on them? On Pauline? On Alice? On Malcolm? Only Malcolm would understand. And even he might find her loathsome now. And she stank of garlic. She would have wept if she hadn't been paralyzed with fear. Hide, she thought. Run and hide. Her mind flew here and there, into the past, into the future, and back quickly into the past again, and found a face she remembered and loved and trusted. Father Coram. He was old now, and he never moved from the Fens, but he was still alive and alert. They wrote to each other from time to time,
and above all, he'd understand her predicament now. But how could she get to him? Her memory, rushing from image to image like a bird trapped inside a room, fluttered against something from the white horse a night or two before. Dick Orchard, and the Egyptian knotted handkerchief around his neck. He'd said something about his grandfather, Giorgio something. He was in Oxford now, wasn't that it? And Dick was working the night shift at the mail depot, so he'd be at home during the day. Yes. She dressed quickly in her warmest clothes, flung some others into the rucksack together with the black notebook and a few other things, looked around the little room she'd come to feel so much at home in, and went downstairs in silence. In the kitchen, she found some paper and a pencil, and left a note.
Sorry. So sorry. And thank you so much.